I titled this series of conversations with young people, The Love of Learning and the Desire for God. I met each person in this series while teaching at Newman Theological College in Edmonton from 2020, during the pandemic, through the fall of 2023. Newman had just introduced a new degree and moved its curriculum into a Great Books and Socratic Dialogue model. I'm joined by Jacqueline Richard in this podcast. I had a lovely afternoon several years ago reading T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets with Jacqueline and her now husband, Reed. On that occasion, she talked about her father's love of the poem and his visit to Little Gidding, an intentional Anglican community of work and prayer established in the 17th century by Nicholas Frower and his mother, Mary Frower. One of the Four Quartets is a meditation on Little Gidding. Jacqueline grew up in a home where fine literature flourished, a superb preparation for what unfolded when she entered Newman Theological College. Prior to entering, she spent several seasons planting trees and parachuting in to fight forest fires in British Columbia. She was in Lytton on June 30th, 2021, when it was destroyed by a forest fire. She came to study at Newman in the shadow of these events preparing her mind and heart for what has unfolded. Welcome to our conversation. So, Jacqueline, good to see you. I met you as part of one of the cohorts at Newman Theological College, where I taught for several years. And I was particularly taken by the shift that I saw at Newman, the kind of educational program that had been developed there when they received a license from the state to have a new BA in Catholic Studies, and did this with a Great Books model in mind. I had studied in Chicago a bit, and the Great Books model had influenced the University of Chicago deeply, and it was pretty much over by the time I was in Chicago, but many of my teachers had gone through that right after the war, the Second World War. So they tended to use that, and I loved it. And then here, when I came back to Edmonton and began to teach a bit myself and what have you, I became pretty concerned about what had happened to the humanities and the loss of all this. So now, in the late stages of my life, to see a kind of renaissance of this at Newman was really so striking to me. And you have come through that. You graduated a year ago now?
Mm-hmm. Last April.
Yeah. April 2024. So you came through that. And I've gotten to know you a little bit and appreciated so much your mind, the way you think, the way you go about your research work, and also your spirit. So I was hoping we could just chat a bit about Newman. But to begin with, I think I'd like to hear a little bit more about your early formation. You mentioned to me when we were reading the Four Quartets in a course at Newman that your father had gone to Little Gidding. So I know that you have a serious formation. So what was your life shaped like as a child? And how did both the love of learning and also the desire for God begin to surface for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was very highly influenced by my parents and their great love for learning, their great reverence for the great books and the life of the mind. So both my parents pursued higher education. My dad studied at Oxford for a little while. He didn't complete his degree there, but he did study there, and it was during that time that he went to Little Gidding, and my mother immersed herself in the English language and got an English degree. And so growing up, the house was full of good books.
Hmm. And where was that?
I grew up in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Vancouver, BC. We had a library that extended down the hall, and whenever my friends came over, they would just be in awe of how many books my parents had collected. So I grew up in this beautiful literary atmosphere. I grew up in the Anglican Church until I was maybe 10 or so. And then as the Anglican Archdiocese in Vancouver encountered problems, my family made the decision to leave and explore other options. So we spent some time in a Baptist church because there was a good youth group there for my brother and I to attend. That was very, very good, very formative. And then...
What Baptist church was that?
It was a Fellowship Baptist church.
I see.
Vancouver, West Point Great Baptist. And so I know
a couple of them, so I was wondering. Yeah.
I certainly have fond memories of my time in the Protestant world. But after a while, we all sensed a certain shallowness there. Not any lack of heart and faith in the people we were around, but an intellectual lack in Protestant theology itself. And so it came to the point when I was, as I said, about 15 or so, and my whole family decided to go through the RCIA program and consider entering the Catholic Church.
RCIA is the kind of educational program the Catholic Church has for people that are discerning whether they want to enter the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. So we did that, and that's when life really started to change quite drastically. Not quickly at first, but we had dipped our toes in something that was going to be quite a swim, although I didn't realize it at the time. And I was very, very blessed because my whole family, the four of us, we went through RCIA together, and we were confirmed and received our first communion the next Easter together.
What year would that have been?
That would have been, I believe, 2015 or 2016.
So almost 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you were how old?
I was 15.
15?
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. We were confirmed the Easter of 2016. So I would have been still 15.
In which church?
It was a Redemptorist parish in Vancouver, Our Lady of Perpetual Help.
Ah.
Yes.
Not Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility, but no. Perpetual Help.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And at that time, I don't think I fully understood what this decision meant in my life, in my family's life.
What did you see in your parents as they went through the RCIA? I mean, the way you spoke about it is that you dipped your toes in something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and they had a sense that the Baptist church was lovely in so many ways, but some sense that they wanted more of the Christian theological world, the Christian world and its teaching about the spiritual life. What did you see in them?
I saw in them a desire for substantial food. They wanted meat. I think they'd been eating in the Anglican Church, and they were in the High Anglican Church when they were younger, and that they really loved that.
And they'd grown up in that?
No, they hadn't.
Wow.
They both came from very different kinds of religious backgrounds, certainly in the Protestant evangelical world, but in different strains. My dad was in a Nazarene church for some time.
Oh, he was the holiness movement.
Mm-hmm. So their journey to the Anglican Church was quite something in itself, and I don't fully know all that entailed, but they fell in love with the High Anglican Church, and then that's what they wanted, my brother and I, to grow up in that.
And the liturgical life as well, because there's a big move between the Nazarenes and a High Anglican Church, which has a much more articulated liturgy. And of course, the High Anglican Church was probably using Cramer mm-hmm. and King James.
Mm-hmm.
So the best of the English language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my parents really were searching after truth, and that led them to the Anglican Church and then eventually into the Catholic Church. And it was their quest for that truth, for that substantial food that I think ultimately caused that conversion. Yeah, and that in turn influenced my brother and I as we saw them on this quest. And it wasn't always easy or obvious or pretty, but they always wanted that which was true. And so when we began our CIA, I saw them just lighting up. They were getting tastes of this world, the Catholic theology and the Catholic liturgy that we were experiencing. It was something more than they had experienced before. And yeah, they really just, it was what they were looking for. It was the truth they wanted and they had been searching for. So I kind of went along with that. And at first, I didn't really know what I was getting into, as I said. And even going through RCIA, it wasn't, you know, fine theological education. It was more of a, this is what the Mass is, and this is...
kind of an introduction.
Mm-hmm.
And a bit on the practical side.
Mm-hmm. It was. And I think we all realized that we would have to do a lot of learning on our own. And I wasn't fully ready for that, although my parents were. And so after we all became Catholic, it was wonderful for a while. And I felt such a draw to the liturgy and the beautiful interiors of the churches, and found a great consolation there. But then after a while, it became habitual, and I fell into that disease of complacency. I would go to Mass as often as I could, but I was going because my family was going, and it wasn't an interior conversion, or at least it didn't turn out to be, although I thought it was. I think the Holy Spirit was working deep inside me, but I think my mind hadn't caught up with things.
You were 15, 16, 17. I mean, come on.
Yes, I was interested in other things perhaps, but so that is how I entered into the church.
And you went through high school in BC?
I was homeschooled.
You were homeschooled?
From grade 1 to 12.
From grade 1 to 12. So that's mm-hmm. a huge matter.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother and father played a role in that?
Very much so.
And how was that shaped?
It was...
Did the state require a particular kind of curriculum? Did you pay attention to that? One of my daughters has homeschooled her children.
Mm.
And she always said, we have a learning environment. And I know that here in Alberta, the education system checks in on homeschooled families periodically, not very often, but once a year, twice a year, something of the sort.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to see that they're getting something that remotely resembles the curriculum. What I've noticed with my grandkids is that when they expressed an interest in something, then my daughter and son-in-law opened the doors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been fantastic to see what that has meant for them as children and how deeply they could drink from those fountains. But how is it shaped for you? I expect a little more formally than for my...
Surprisingly, no.
Was that right?
We were, I would say, rogue homeschoolers. So I don't have a high school diploma.
Uh-huh.
I never fulfilled those requirements, at least on paper, for what the province required as a showing that I'd passed high school. So
congratulations. You and I now share something.
Okay.
Because I never got one of those either.
Well, there we go. Yeah. So in the earlier years of homeschooling, it was a little bit more formal. We would check in with a learning assistant every now and then, and she would make sure we were on course. And then when I got into high school, the option was either take online classes that were prescribed by the province or do what we wanted to do. And we chose that option. So I spent my high school years mostly on my own, reading books. And my mom helped me to the extent that she could, but it was a rather solitary experience. But I am grateful for it because I was able to pursue things that really interested me.
What did you read?
I read lots of different things. I was...
Give me a little picture of the range.
I was immersed in Jane Austen for a long time, Charlotte Bronte, Emily Bronte.
So the realist novels.
Mm-hmm. Realist novels. And meanwhile, I read some philosophy, but I never really understood it very well. I didn't really have the tools to dissect it. Yeah. So I think in terms of fiction, I loved the realist novels, some fantasy, some historical fiction. And I read biography of Samuel Johnston, which I loved. And we went through the Winston Churchill historical series.
Oh, really?
History of England. And
he never graduated from high school either, if I recall correctly.
Okay, well, I'm in good company.
I think they
then.
Failed him in English.
Really?
Yeah.
I also loved poetry. So you mentioned T.S. Eliot, and I developed a great love for him. And for others, Emily Dickinson, William Blake, and I would try to memorize as much poetry as I could. And some of those poems are still with me now as companions, which I'm thankful for. I keep meaning to add to their number, but it's hard to find time to memorize poetry. But something I love to do. Yeah. Sheldon Van Auken was another favorite. So... yeah, I don't know if that gives you a bit of a range.
Interesting. And you followed your nose.
Followed my nose.
And your parents let you do that.
They did. Meanwhile, I was very much into the into fine art. And so I spent many, many hours painting and drawing. Mm-hmm. And because I didn't have online classes to do, I had the time for that. Mm-hmm. I spent about 100 hours learning Greg shorthand off of a YouTube series.
Wow.
So I kind of had free rein. Mm-hmm. And my brother was the same way, although his interests tended towards the bicycle. And so he would be out racing and riding and coaching for a lot of the time.
You know, the bicycle is the most amazing mechanical machine that human beings ever invented. Ivan Illich writes an essay on the bicycle.
Oh, really?
Because the bicycle... the amount of energy, when you take it all into account, to both acquire the materials to build a bicycle, which means mining and all that, as well as the kind of paths that bicycle goes on, all that infrastructure, bicycles are like no other mechanical object in the world.
Really?
They require the least energy to give you the most capacity.
Wow.
Yeah, the bicycle is unique.
Huh.
So you begin to come through your teenage years. What happened? What happened next?
I got to the point where I had done so much reading and so much studying that I was sick of it and I needed to go do something with my hands.
Ah.
And so that's what led into the next phase of my life, which was dominated by a desire to become a firefighter. Initially, I wanted to become a structural firefighter. And so to do that, I signed up for wildfire. I ended up doing that for 4 summers. And before that, I had done some tree planting as well. So I felt the need for adventure. I'd spent my whole homeschool years sitting on a couch reading. And now I needed to go out and do something hard and test my limits and see what it was like to fail and to come up against the objective limitations of the material world, which is somewhat hard to do when you're living in your mind.
Yeah.
Although I think I'd had some of that with my artistic training, mm-hmm. because of course there are mm-hmm. physical mm-hmm. limitations there. But so anyway, yeah, I tree planted for a summer. That was very hard, but very wonderful. And
where was that?
That was in, I started near Prince George, BC.
Northern BC.
Northern mm-hmm. BC, and then we came into Alberta later in the mm-hmm. summer. Yeah, that led into...
And that put you in touch with a different group of people as well.
It did. Yeah, although they weren't as dissimilar to me as I thought they mm-hmm. would be. Mm-hmm. I ended up in a tree planting camp full of Christians. They were all Orthodox, mm-hmm. and we had Bible studies every week.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of my tree planting colleagues were also homeschooled. So.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
That's not what I expected. But I think that tree planting camp was a bit of an anomaly, because often the stereotype of tree planting camps are, you know, rife with alcohol and drug use and all that. But that
my daughter did some tree. One of my daughters did some tree planting, and on her cohort of tree planters, unbeknownst to her, of course, when she got brought into it by a helicopter, it turned out that five of them, I think, had brought Plato's Republic with them.
Really?
So they spent the evenings reading Plato.
Amazing.
So, I mean, that appears to occur.
I think it does.
In tree planting.
Yeah. But, yeah, that was a...
And then the firefighting, wildfires, forest fires.
Forest fires, yeah.
And yeah. You were at Lytton, weren't you?
I was, yep. So I...
That's a small town that was completely decimated by forest fires a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was there for two seasons, and my last season was the year that it was all burned down. So that was quite an experience, and that was tied to my journey to Newman, actually, that whole experience. So.
And during that firefighting, you were jumping out of planes, I think, a bit, weren't you?
The last two seasons. So I spent two seasons in Lytton. And then after the second season, I came to Newman, did my first semester of studies. And then I transferred up to Fort St. John, BC, and joined the Paratac smoke jumping program up there. And so, yes, we would access fires by plane. We would parachute out to them.
And that's around the time that I met you, and you were... If I recall correctly, you mentioned to me that there was a colleague that was involved in that as well, or maybe several, who had been reading Stoicism, and you had gotten somewhat interested in the Stoic understanding. I think our first conversations were largely about that.
Yeah, I think throughout my time in Wildfire, I was really wrestling with this idea of what are human limitations, and how is the mind capable of pushing past some of those limitations to achieve things that wouldn't otherwise be achievable? And so this train of thought led me eventually to considering the Stoics, who I found fascinating because they seemed so able to take the world in stride mm-hmm. and able to take events that came, but with a steadiness and a lack of becoming overpowered by their emotions. Mm-hmm. There was a certain control there, and that's what I aspired to.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I find Stoicism interesting because even in the secular world, there's quite an interest in it, mm-hmm. and it's held up as a bit of an ideal.
And that's recent.
Mm-hmm.
Quite recent. Mm-hmm. I was at a bookstore here within the last year, and I was a little taken aback by how many books on Stoicism were on the shelves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite interesting.
Do you think that suggests something about our culture?
I think it suggests that there's a general sense that we've gone too far towards indulgence and towards following our impulses as far as they go.
Mm-hmm.
There's, I think, a desire, and I see this a lot in young people, a desire to go back to discipline, to go back to order, to fight our interior chaos and find some kind of system for doing so. I think Jordan Peterson speaks to that quite a bit as well in some of his writing. He talks about this need for order in our lives and how to get back to that and how to find hierarchies again, which are very, very unfashionable in our society.
And authority.
And authority. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Stoicism touches on that as well. So, as you mentioned, I had a colleague in Wildfire who was a quite a well-known personage in the the social media world, and he's American and used to be a Navy SEAL and has written a number of books. He's quite a presence on social media and these sorts of things. And it just so happened that I went through Smoke Jumper boot camp with him. He's an older fellow who's getting closer to 50, and yet he was beating all of us by a long shot in the runs and the physical exercises there. But he is involved with a Stoic organization in the States. And a lot of his mindset and philosophy is it uses many, many Stoic ideas. He's all his modus operandi, if you will, is that we are able to control our minds and we are able to achieve extraordinary things with our bodies. We are able to push ourselves past our limitations. And this is inspiring for people. This really is, because it's easy to get stuck, you know, stuck in what we think we can do.
It's one of the attractions of sport.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one place where it still exists in this society.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think people love watching sports and the Olympics and these sorts of things because they show people who have surpassed limitations and have trained their bodies to do extraordinary things. So, yeah, I certainly felt the appeal of this mindset and really appreciated him and talking with him and learning from him. He helped me through a lot. At one point, well, there was this big training apparatus we had, and it was basically this big tower. You're attached with a harness and kind of like this bungee thing, and you're supposed to jump off, simulating jumping out of an airplane. And it's only about 15 feet off the ground, so it's not very high. But there was one day where I just couldn't jump. And I got stuck in my head, and there was nothing that was going to make me jump off of that tower. But thankfully, this colleague of mine was right behind me, and he told me in no uncertain terms, get back in that door and jump, or else you never will.
Yeah.
And I did. Mm-hmm. And it helped me so much to have him there.
Mm-hmm.
I think without him, I may not have made it through the training, because he really showed me that I could fight through my fear.
Yeah.
Because I was terrified of jumping out of planes.
Yeah.
And I still am.
Yeah.
But he helped me to break down the different physical processes that occurred leading up to the jump, to analyze them and figure out how I could cope with each one as it arose.
Mm.
Yeah, so it was great to have him there.
Interesting.
And he certainly increased my interest in Stoicism. And so when I eventually, you know, began studying that in Newman, I think it was in one of your classes, actually, that I delved into that more deeply. It became, an intellectual pursuit as well. I was really asking the question, can we as Christians be Stoics?
Mm-hmm.
Or what are the limitations of Stoicism?
Mm-hmm.
Is it something that can be embraced while one is also embracing Christ? So these were the questions that came up for me.
A lot of Stoicism in the early Christian tradition.
Mm-hmm.
How did you make the decision to come to Newman? How did that arise?
It's a bit of a long story.
It must be.
Yeah.
Because you're in Vancouver. How did it come about?
I spent time, you know, being out in the bush, doing things with my hands. And then there was a shift back in my heart, and I realized I needed to nurture my mind again. I needed to learn. I needed to have the tools to think about some of the things I wanted to think about, but that my toolbox was empty at that point. Or not empty, because I'd had a very rich homeschooling experience, but it was still, the tools weren't as developed as they needed to be. And so I decided to do some study again. And at first that took me to a small college in Vancouver where I studied for, I think collectively, only about 1 year.
What was that?
It was Corpus Christi College in Vancouver.
It's a Catholic school.
It is, yeah. So I did 2 semesters there, but they were a little bit split up. And that was very good. One class in particular really ignited my love for philosophy. And that was a class taught by this fantastic professor who actually still teaches at Corpus. And it was a class on the philosophy of the human person. And that class changed my life. I got rid of my smartphone and I got a flip phone. I rethought how I interacted with people.
Mm-hmm.
It led me to really desire to pursue philosophy. This was partly the way that it was taught. It was partly this teacher and just the gentle way that he walked us through these concepts. But it was also the concepts themselves. I'm just thinking about what it means to be a human person and a human person in relation with other human persons. So that was what started it for me, I think. And then it took a little while, but eventually I realized I would like to do a degree in liberal arts. Corpus Christi didn't offer that. And I had taken a few other classes there that kind of put me off academics, shall we say, a little bit. Just, you know, classes that were good enough, but there was no love for learning in them.
No fire.
There was no fire, as there had been in this one class that I took. So,
who was that professor?
His name was Jay Irwin.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's nice to hear the names of professors that do that.
Yeah. I still keep in touch with him when we go to Vancouver. We see him. He's just fantastic. After a while, I had done a little bit of studying at Corpus Christi, and then I took some time off again and was, you know, tree planting and wildfire and these kinds of things. And then I sensed a need again to pursue philosophy, pursue the liberal arts. And so I was looking up online. I typed in Catholic philosophy programs in Canada, and Newman popped up.
And AI does it for you.
Yes. I'm not much of a technology person, but I do think the Holy Spirit sometimes works through it. And
you'd never heard of Newman.
I'd never heard of Newman. I had no intention whatsoever of ever living in Alberta.
Well, you're from BC.
Yeah.
It's a standard view. And we're happy for that here in Alberta.
Yes. Yeah, so I heard about Newman. I applied for the program. I think I was the very first application to the BA program because I applied in March. And the program was set to start in September. And it was brand new.
And COVID had started.
COVID had started. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there had been a cohort of seminarians that went through first.
Right. So you were the first non-seminarian cohort because they got the program was certified by the province actually in the summer.
Oh.
And so they couldn't really open it up to anybody else. And it was COVID. Mm-hmm. And there was a cohort in the seminary. So, yeah. So you were the first for the next cohort.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then that summer, so the summer between, or right before Newman, was the summer that Lytton burned down. And It was a time of purging for me in many different ways.
You were in Lytton.
I was in Lytton, and I had an apartment there. That was my community. It was my second summer there, so I was volunteering with the fire department, and I was going to the gym, and I was even starting to do a series of paintings of the different sites around Lytton to kind of display at the little coffee shop there. So I was really investing in the community. I loved it. It's this little tiny village. You can walk from one end to the other in about 10 minutes. Beautiful people there. People who've lived there many, many years and have chosen that particular life because they like the quietness of it. Lytton is right at the confluence of the Fraser River and the Thompson River. And it's a very significant place for many of the indigenous communities that live in that area as well. So, yeah, I was living there fighting fires in the area, putting down roots. And then, yeah, we had a heat wave in June. And yeah, it was funny because Newman put out a scholarship competition for this new cohort of the BA program, and I'd applied for it just because I thought, well, you know, doesn't hurt to try. And so I wrote an essay on faith and reason, and I can't really remember what I wrote, but I was writing it during this heat wave when it was so hot in Lytton. It was about 53 degrees in the sun, and we would fry eggs on metal countertops outside. and it was like a ticking time bomb. And so on June 30th, there was a spark down by the railroad tracks, and within 13 minutes, the whole town was engulfed in flame. I was not in the town for the very beginning of that because my crew was on a fire. We were fighting a fire just south of Lytton at the time, and we got a call back saying, you need to get back to Lytton. And so we hopped in our truck and we were, you know, joking and laughing all the way there because we just fought this little grass fire and we were in great spirits. And we got into Lytton and couldn't see anything. And we didn't know what was going on. I didn't know that it had burned because it was all smoky. And we were sent up to a neighborhood above, kind of in this upper section of Lytton, which was above the highway. So Highway 1 runs by Lytton, and the main town is below it, between the river and the highway. And then above the highway, there's this neighborhood that kind of is adjacent to the forest. And so we were sent up there to basically evacuate people and try to stop the fire. And the wind was so strong that there was nothing really we could do. We got our fire hoses out and we were trying to put out house fires, but it would just jump from house to house. And we were in all of that smoke, breathing it in. We had no breathing apparatuses or anything. and at that point, still, I didn't know that my home had burned down. But then eventually I found that out, and my crew as well lost everything. And
did you lose your application?
No. Well, yes, actually, I did. My computer burned down.
Yeah.
It burned up. And I thought, oh, well, that's it. You know, this scholarship all very well. And then we kept fighting the fire basically all that night because it was spreading up north towards Lillooet. And it was close to midnight. The application deadline for this scholarship competition was July 1st at midnight. And at 11 p.m., an hour before it was due, we were trying to stop this fire from going up towards Lillooet. And I jumped into the fire truck and I'd lost my phone charger and all that, and my phone was dead. So I borrowed my crew leader's phone and I called my parents and I asked them, can you get into my Google account and submit this essay for me? Uh-huh. And they did. And I thought no more of it at the time, because the next few days and weeks were just trying to piece together bits of life that had just kind of
disappeared. So it was purgation.
It was. Yeah. Yeah. It was a beautiful but hard experience to just lose everything suddenly. And not only that, not only my personal things, but also to lose a community, because everyone fled. Yeah, two people didn't make it out in time, but thankfully everyone else did from the village. So the whole village was just gone, dispersed. And the fire crews stayed there. Well, after a few weeks, we were able to come back. And so we lived at the fire base and kept responding to fires in the area. But it was gone. So it was kind of God's way of, in a way, purging some of these, I think, unholy attachments I had to firefighting and to some of the things that I shouldn't have placed my identity in. And then a few weeks later, I got an email saying, oh, you've won the scholarship. Which I was blown away by.
Who did that come from?
Dr. Topping.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was the one that mm-hmm. put together this mm-hmm. scholarship and was really trying to draw mm-hmm. students to the program.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the rest of that summer was just kind of limping through, and I didn't know what was going to happen. And we were kind of homeless, my fire crew and I, traveling around the province. And then we had a deployment in Vernon, BC, right before I came to Lytton. And so I think Sunday evening I was cutting trail with a chainsaw up a mountain in Vernon. And then Monday I jumped in my truck, drove to Edmonton. And Tuesday morning I was sitting in orientation at Newman.
What?
Severely disorientated. So
did you bring your chainsaw?
No, I didn't, sadly. So my coming to Newman was a bit of a whirlwind.
Well, that's for sure.
And it was a bit of a culture shock being there as well, because all of the beautiful ladies were wearing long skirts. And I didn't know I'd be studying with seminarians.
Mm.
I didn't know anything about Newman. I just knew it was a liberal arts school and that I was going there because I had a scholarship there. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I can say that Newman was life-changing for me in so many different ways. And of course that needs to be unpacked, but mm-hmm.
it was such
a gift to be there, to be around the people, my classmates, and to really delve into Catholicism, into the ocean that, as I said before, I'd just been kind of dipping my toes in while being distracted by a myriad of other things. It was a time to really understand what my conversion to Catholicism had meant and what it would mean for the rest of my life.
So you went through orientation. There was a set of classes laid out.
Mm-hmm.
Let's speak about the love of learning piece of this first.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that that first term, did you take a philosophy stream?
Mm-hmm. We did. Yeah. At that point, it was, I think we took Historical Introduction to Philosophy, Dr. Fast. That was our first. We took one of those classes each semester,
uh-huh.
our first year.
And he had you read your way from the pre-Socratics on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And reflect on each of them a bit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we started with the Iliad.
Ah, you started with the Iliad.
Right into the the midst of the battlefield.
Yeah.
And reflecting back on it, I think, my whole summer was a bit of a battlefield.
That's right.
And so yeah. As I...
You'd been there.
I delved into the Iliad. It was somewhat familiar. But it was just a completely different world, suddenly, being at Newman and reading books, reading good books, not just reading textbooks, mm-hmm. primary sources.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were given this list of books to read, and each one looked so amazing. And then we weren't just lectured. We were told to talk about the books. And that was really hard at first, because I certainly didn't really know how to engage in Socratic dialogue. And I think many of my classmates were still learning as well. And so there were lots of times in the class where no one really knew what to say, but we were all wrestling with some of these ideas in our minds and trying to figure out how to verbalize them. And our teachers would help us to put words to it, and they would lead our minds through some of these ideas. And I'm reminded of John Henry Newman's idea of the integrated habit of mind.
Mm-hmm.
How learning is, it's about becoming more fully a person. It's about integrating these diverse aspects of our lives into one cohesive whole as we search for truth. And ultimately, of course, God is truth. And so it's a search for God. Yeah, with that, there comes this love for God, love for learning as the thing which leads us towards God. And a lot of the professors at Newman were able to foster this in us, students,
mm-hmm.
lead us and guide us. And it wasn't easy. There were many classes I just didn't understand. I felt like I was swimming in a very, very, very deep sea. Mm-hmm. There might be sharks. But the way that the curriculum at Newman is designed is that in the first year, it's kind of like surfing along the top, getting a taste of lots of different kinds of things. And then in the second year, there's more of an opportunity to go in depth into things. And likewise, in the third year, when we all did our senior thesis, that was really the opportunity to go deeply into something.
And integrate a bit.
And integrate, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the first year at Newman, especially because all of the classes were so complementary.
Mm-hmm.
One class would be talking about the same themes as another class, but just in a slightly different way. And it felt like we were given this integrated vision of the search for truth. In the second year, the integration was something we had to fight for ourselves a little bit more. And that was good too, because mm-hmm. we had to look harder for things. Yeah, but it was a very, very well-designed set of classes.
That synergy between classes, I experienced it on the side of a teacher with students who, when they would begin to talk and think about what was before us, they would bring to bear what they had been working at, sometimes the year before, or in another class. It was beautiful. I mean, I think it was just simply beautiful to see. Another element of it that was striking to me, and I was wondering how you might have experienced this, and that is the relationship between the students. You're a cohort There are students from a previous year. There's also the seminary cohort. It occurred to me that this was great for the seminarians. This is where I stand, of course, so who knows? But it seemed to me that the seminarians, lovely young men, some of them a little bit older, some of them not older at all, this was an opportunity for them to hear lay people, people who were not in their trajectory towards priesthood, although relatively few of them ever finish, engage with lay people around important questions and important ideas, and particularly women as well. I think one of the challenges of, and I mean, it's not for me to say, but I think about these things even if it's not for me to say them. One of the challenges of the Catholic priesthood is if you were to go to a junior seminary and then on to a seminary, I mean, you would spend 10 years with relatively few conversations with women. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've known many priests and they've all said to me that this is something that needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. So I could see that, and I've talked with a number of the seminarians, and that this has been very rich for them. Mm-hmm. And something that they've treasured. So this relationship to the students, because at Newman, I know in your period there, my period there, there were lots of occasions where you would read and think together with three or four other students. And that's a lovely thing to do. Mm. Because you hear different things coming from the heart and the mind of those that are there.
Yeah, that's so true. There were many times we could, and we were encouraged to bounce ideas off of one another and learn from each other. It was also just wonderful to study with my fellow students and to learn where they were coming from and what their backgrounds were and what they were bringing to Newman, because mm-hmm. everyone brought something so different. Mm-hmm. Of mm-hmm. course, the seminarians brought something different from the lay students, but even each seminarian had their own,
of course,
their own thoughts, their own ideas, their own background that they were coming with. And so a lot of the learning at Newman was also just learning from my peers, learning how they thought, how they went about things, seeing how they would struggle with certain ideas, the same mm-hmm. ideas I was struggling with. So yeah, it was a very, very rich experience. And also to be in a cohort that we were together the whole 3 years of our time at Newman. And that was wonderful because we got to see each other develop.
Yeah.
See our minds develop.
And the maturing.
Yeah. And I think back to some of my friends when I first met them, how different they are now and how beautiful that journey has been to walk with them in, to see how they've changed and gained more confidence and more depth, more maturity, more beauty. To see some of my seminarian colleagues and how they have, as they slowly approach the priesthood, how they have really accepted that and are leaning into different elements of that and growing in readiness for that. Of course, mm-hmm. I'm sure they never feel they'll fully be ready, but mm-hmm. who is fully ready for a vocation? Mm-hmm. So.
And the other aspect of Newman that I also found so beautiful was the liturgical rhythm, both the liturgical rhythm that Newman itself has, but particularly given both some of the professors as well as some of the students and some of the seminarians who, of course, pray the office every day, the way in which they invited others to join in that. So there's the Divine Liturgy, the Mass, and then there's the office that was being prayed periodically together, and that rhythm is there as well. And it shapes life. And then for many of the students, or at least a number of them that I'm familiar with, and I believe you, the rhythm of the liturgy took a particular turn. And you also sought to have the presence of that in your life very, very regularly. And if I recall correctly, you also sought to have it in terms of the Latin Mass.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
It was because of some of my friends from Newman, some of my my classmates who attended the Latin Mass, and they invited me to come. And I thought, oh no, I don't understand Latin. I don't want to go to something like that. That's far too complex. But I did go once, and it felt like the first time I'd ever been to a Catholic Mass. I just didn't know what was going on. People were kneeling and standing and sitting at odd times, and I couldn't understand anything. So it took me a while before I would go back again. And then I decided my second year at Newman that I was going to make the Latin Mass parish my parish. So I moved into an apartment across the street, and I'd go there as often as I could. And I think
it was Mass every morning, wasn't there? Almost every morning?
Mass almost every morning.
Before school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my first year at Newman, I would go to the liturgies at Newman. And those were just beautiful. And I really loved the silence and the reverence of those. But then my second year at Newman, I started going to the Latin Mass in the mornings before class. And I think it's a continuation of my journey into Catholicism, finding the Latin Mass. There's something about it that is beyond words. It speaks to the mystery of our faith. Yeah, the new Mass is beautiful in many ways, and I do appreciate it. But I think there can sometimes be a lack of emphasis on that mystery, whereas in the Latin Mass, the words themselves are a mystery. The priest has his back turned to the people, and it's not about us.
It's a different orientation.
It's a different orientation. We are all oriented towards what is going on the altar. And I just found it so wonderful to be able to partake in that. Eventually, I got a missal so I could follow along with some of the Latin prayers, but my first experience of the Latin Mass was simply sitting in silence and listening. And I think that's an attitude that we all need more of in our lives, is just sitting and listening. And the Latin Mass, I find, helps to cultivate that.
And it's also much more difficult to presume when you don't know the language.
It's true.
I mean, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
So if you don't know the language, even if you have a sense of what's taking place, and you may know it in part from your experience in the English Mass. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
The disposition, it gives you a distinct disposition. I know that in my work, you know, part of my work over many years, my field research work in religious traditions was largely about just being present to worship and adoration in temples, synagogues, mosques, gurudwaras, in homes. And of course, I know none of these languages. I've studied the traditions. I have a little sense of it. But, I mean, I'm not quite sure what the words are for this. You listen differently when you cannot presume about its meaning. There's a teaching of some of the patristic church fathers who say you should never memorize scripture. And what they really mean is it needs to be fresh every time. It needs to be fresh every time to you. So be careful They don't really mean not memorize. They really mean be careful. Don't assume that you've, because you have memorized it, because you've learned the words, that that's where the meaning is. And of course, the Jewish tradition is so good on this because it has many disciplines about cultivating our capacity to hear the silence between the words, to listen as we listen to music, where we hear the notes, the rhythm, the movement, but mostly we hear the silence because the silence contains and holds it all. So, yeah, it's interesting how that works.
Yeah.
So it's been lovely to hear how you have thought about this. You've now been away from Newman, I mean, as a student for a year. Can you give me just a little sense of two or three of the things that in your mind and in your heart you've received from this experience?
I think one thing is that I came into Newman thinking that I knew everything. I thought I knew it all. And over the course of those 3 years, I realized just how much I don't know. And I feel that now I'm at a place where I feel that I know nothing, nothing at all. And that's a beautiful place to be because it's a place of receptivity. It's not a place of presumption.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to cultivate that more, certainly. But Newman really helped me to get rid of some of those presumptions that I had about myself, about learning.
About the world?
About the world, too. Yeah, I thought that, you know, if you've read a few books on a few different things, you know, all there is to be known. But then I was given these reading lists at Newman that were about things I hadn't even thought could be thought about. So, I think I'm at a better starting place now to really learn, which sounds strange after doing a 3-year degree. But I think I've been given tools to really pursue that habit of learning throughout the rest of my life. And that is a great gift. That really is. Because now I can approach the intellectual life with a better attitude towards it. An attitude of more humility, in a way. Less presumption. More of an attitude of, let me receive what I can. And some of it I won't understand, but I will do my best to, rather than an attitude of, I already know. I'm already, you know, well enough formed in certain things that I believe, and I don't need anything to challenge that. Thank you very much. So that has been a very, very great gift that Newman has given.
Does it also mean that you realize that there are some things, some thinkers, for example, some perspectives that are difficult to understand, that you may not understand, and some that you may really disagree with, but how good it is to become fond of them anyways?
It's true. And I think you've helped me a lot with that in your classes. Really helped me to see that We can read and study people who are very, very, you know, they're a far cry from, you know, what perhaps is true, but it's still so rewarding to grapple with them and get them in a headlock and try to understand, okay, why do you think the way that you do, and learn from them, and then come back to our own ideas with
richness.
Richness, yeah.
new kind of richness.
Yeah, so it's so true. And that's something that throughout Newman has been wonderful, because we haven't just read one perspective on things. Even in philosophy classes, we certainly started with Aquinas and people who are more in line with the Catholic intellectual tradition. But then we studied Kant, Descartes, Rousseau, Nietzsche. We were given the opportunity to see what these people had to say,
mm-hmm.
and then evaluate that,
mm-hmm.
and see, okay, what can we draw from them and what do we need to lay aside? But then to lay it aside gently and not in any attitude of contempt, or to have great respect for these thinkers. I have a great respect for Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's wrong about a lot of things, but he's wonderful to read because...
It's marvelous.
As you've said, he's like holding fire.
In your hand.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that one of the greatest gifts of having a chance to study is, as you have articulated it, it doesn't humiliate you. It does humble. You know, humus. We're in the earth. We're in the nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
of what has made the culture, the world we stand, all of these people whose shoulders we stand upon. And that also, I mean, my sense is it makes it wonderful to be human. You know, it's so wonderful to be human.
Yeah, it makes one realize just what a beautiful thing life is.
Yeah.
And the opportunities that we have to grow intellectually, mm-hmm. spiritually. They're such gifts that God has given us, the way he's designed even the human mind and how it learns. It would be so boring if we were born knowing everything.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be no difference among people.
Well, yeah. Lovely. Lovely to chat with you and hear about it. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Goh. It's been wonderful.
Thank you for joining us. Jacqueline has a fine theological mind, mature beyond her years. She came to Newman already thinking in subtle ways and having glimpsed what nature and friendship have to offer. 3 years in the presence of the love of learning bequeathed to her a receptivity to what she didn't know, kindled her interest in the gifts of the West's intellectual tradition, including those thinkers outside the pale of her Catholic faith. She made friends with all of them and established a habit of mind that she will carry throughout her life. She saw richness of thought and insight in others, and the joy that arises in engaging even those who we do not and perhaps are unable to understand. Her desire for God, nurtured by the daily office of the Church and the Mass, opened a pathway to the mystery of all that greets us through the wonder of being. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.